Accession number 28462, Reel 7.
Truck came out and our petty officer said, "You all right, sir?" I said, "Yes, but we've got no fuel. You'll have to tow it in."
And what did you say to your observer?
I didn't say anything, actually. We went to be debriefed, and I was amazed, actually, because nobody seemed to say anything. And the only answer we got was that our distress signals hadn't been acknowledged, because it happened to be the signal at the time for enemies landing in large numbers on the beach. So they'd all kept quiet.
Reel change coming up.
So
hang on, let me just, can I? So Ian Templer, reel 7.
So that was that.
So we're now in about, what, October 1942?
Yep. We are now in October 1942, and we go into November. And now, of course, October the... I think it was October the... what was the date of the Alamein battle, when it really broke out in advance? I think it must have been the 28th or 29th, because 29th... we started illuminating in the desert again, or I did, into November, by which time the Africa Corps were in full retreat and were getting out of our range.
Sorry, I just want to stop it briefly and start it. Fine, okay, sorry.
You've got that bit, did you?
No, I'm sorry, the yeah. Africa Corps were...
The Africa Corps were in full retreat and getting out of our range, so we were pulled out and transferred to Malta. And just about that time, I had an attack of what eventually turned out to be appendicitis, so I was grounded. The rest of them flew off to Malta, and I went by sea with all the ground crew and all the equipment in a little, it was a Hunt-class destroyer, I think. Joined up with them again, and I was flying again December the 12th. We did a...
Sorry, just that voyage from Alexandria to Malta. I mean, coming into Malta by sea, that must have been into that grand harbour, which must have been littered with wrecks.
Yes,
can you tell me a little about that? I mean, what impression that made upon you?
I can't, honestly. You know, it's one of these things where, you know, you come into a spot, and you're moved off somewhere else quickly.
Sure.
I did see it later on when I was back in Malta a bit later on. I saw a lot more of what had happened. But again, one was so preoccupied with what you've got to do next or what's going to happen. And that's something that has already happened. And I know it sounds cold-blooded, but I don't know, there must have been a sort of numbness about one where you realise that these things were going to happen, they could happen to you any minute, or if you're lucky, they didn't.
So you come back to Malta, you've got a grumbling appendicitis.
Yeah. Yes, I did three operations, I think, from there. Mine laying. We did a search with torpedoes and didn't find a target. We did another one and didn't find a target, and we bombed a place called Sousse, which is Tunisia, I think. And then my final operation was a search for a convoy in Tunis Bay. I was the lead aircraft, and I had two long-range tanks, I had a long-range tank with an observer and an air gunner, telegraphist, and the other three had torpedoes and an observer and a long-range tank in the back. My long-range tank was underneath. We didn't find the target, and by that time we were beyond the point of no return, so we had to follow instructions and go to Bone in Algeria, not very far from Algiers. Now, I'd been struck with this chronic grumbling appendix all the time, all that flight, which was a bit unpleasant. And the next morning, we landed at Bone all right in the middle of the night. Unfortunately, it was a sea of mud. And for some reason or other, the resident squadron said, well, leave the aircraft here, we'll move them in the morning. Somebody somewhere knew that those aircraft had landed and they'd got torpedoes on. And we had a Stuka raid in the morning and they were all written off. They were able, in fact, to patch one up from the bits of the other. So the three of us, three aircraft were lost for no purpose at all.
And you were there during this raid?
Yeah, we were watching it.
What, from a shelter?
From a safe distance, yeah.
Someone had blown a whistle on you, obviously.
Well, I think so. I mean, the place was full of informers, obviously. And I mean, somebody knew that these four albacores had come in. They were armed. What were they going to do? They were going to go and do the Germans no good, so they thought they'd get them. I'm sure that's what must have happened. So we had then
to... You were marooned in Bone?
No, we didn't, actually. We got to... we were moved, sent over to Algiers, where there was one of the fast mine layers, HMS Welshman, which was going to Malta in the night. It had to do a night crossing. And we were embarked in that, three of us. The crew whose aircraft had suffered least wanted to fly it back, so I said, well, okay, you do that. And we embarked in the Welshman. She set sail at dusk and absolutely full blow. She could do 35, 40 knots, I think, and it was belting through the night, and she rolled. We had hammocks slung in the wardroom, and she was rolling at least 45 degrees. You wondered sometimes, was she going to come back again? And the wardroom furniture was sliding from one side to the other. And eventually, we got into Malta unscathed and back to base. Then I went and saw the doc and said, look, either there's nothing wrong with me, in which case I'm suffering from lack of moral fibre, or there is something wrong with me. So he sent me to the senior surgeon, who said, well, it can't really be anything but a grumbling appendix. Would you like to have them removed here, or would you like to go home? And I said, well, I'll have them here. He said, well, I think you're wise, because if you go home, they'll probably lose sight of you. It'll take a long time to get into hospital, and we can do you here next week, sort of thing. So that was done, and then I had about 3 weeks convalescence there, and was flown then to Gibraltar, and then in a troop ship, another Dutch ship, I think, very, very comfortable, very luxurious, back to Liverpool.
So you went back?
Yep.
Not in connection with your illness?
Yes, it was because, I went back because... I couldn't fly again until I'd had a full medical, and they hadn't got the facilities to do that in Malta. So they said I'd have to go back then. So I went back, got into Liverpool, rang my mother up and said, I'll be home in an hour. Good God, she said. She had no idea I was so near. I had had quite a while on leave.
This was the first time you'd been back to Liverpool for more than a year.
Oh, yes. Where are we? 19...
42, late 42, and you'd left in...
I'm early 43, actually.
Oh, right.
And I'd left in... I'd left in late 41. I hadn't been home. I must have been home for a short time, sometime in 40 or 41.
Were you shocked when you saw... Because Liverpool had probably been pretty badly hit in...
Oh, yes, it had, yes.
And was that a...
Because I remember being at home when Liverpool was being bombed. It was terrible. And that was actually this time when I went home.
It was bombed in...
43.
Oh, right.
Must have been, I think, because that was the only time I was home for any length of time. And I had to go down to Leon Solent to get my medical done. And passed back for flying duties. So I was told to wait at home for the next appointment. Got a telegram one day to go to Glasgow to join HMS Dasher. And I thought it was funny, why haven't they appointed me to a squadron? Why just to a ship? Because I wasn't qualified to be any kind of a ship's officer. Anyway, the next day it was cancelled. And I discovered quite a long time later that the Dasher had blown up in the Clyde when she was refueling. And I think I'm right in saying there were 9 survivors. Dreadful. And I was sent instead to Arbroath, to 754 Squadron, which was an observer training squadron. So I was sort of sent there more or less as a driver to take the observer trainees on their exercises, which it was a very pleasant life, actually.
Was this in a way to give you a bit of R&R after, I mean, they recognise that you've been in operations for...
I think it was probably to give me a bit of a rest, or they wanted another pilot then, they didn't know what else to do with me. And we flew albacores, a Lysander's there, of all things. You know the Lysander?
The Lysander's a monoplane, isn't it? Across the top?
Yeah, like a parasol. Took me a long time to get hold of a photograph of one. And, that.
Right.
They were the ones that were used to drop agents into France quite a lot because they could land in a very short and take off in a very short space. Anyway, the Navy had quite a lot of them for this purpose.
And how did you find them as aircraft?
Oh, lovely, easy. The only thing was I was warned when you take off, particularly in cold weather, not to leave it at full throttle for too long because the carburetors were liable to ice up, in which case you've got no power. But that didn't happen. So the only problem with them is that quite often in the morning you'd have to go round 3 or 4 to find one that was fully serviceable. And then having done that one morning, I took off with these 2 chaps in the back, picked up the Gosport tube to tell them, to tell me what they wanted to do. No answer. They haven't plugged it in. So I had to go back and land and get them plugged in and go off again.
What is a Gosport tube? I don't know what that is.
The Gosport tube was the old-fashioned method of communicating from the pilot to the observer. And it was like a sort of hollow microphone and a tube which carried your voice to the other chap's earplugs in his helmet.
So he actually physically...
No, you had to plug it in.
First lesson for an observer, yeah. I suppose. So, when you say you're taking observers out, what kind of exercises would you have been doing?
They used to do wind finding, astro navigation exercises, land navigation exercises, sea navigation exercises, wind finding exercises, all that sort of thing. Hello, darling.
Hello. Are you stopping for lunch or are you going to...
Well, Nick says he's not bothered on.
Sorry, I'll have to stop it. I forgot what the time was. I switched off. Okay.
Should I have a banana?
Oh, that's a good idea, darling.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Would you like one?
Yes, I'd love one. Thanks.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cheers. What about a drink?
Well, I've just had some water.
Oh.
I'll come and get some more if we want some more.
Some more.
I say, if we want some more, I'll come again. Don't worry, darling.
Thank you. That's fine. Well, this is a banana break. Okay, so we're rolling now. Yeah.
While I was there, a chap called Alistair Black, who I'd flown with in Egypt and in Malta, turned up and said, I'm going to America to join an Avenger squadron. How would you feel about crewing up with me again? And I said, well, fine, because I liked him. He was a very nice chap, easy to get on with, and a very good navigator. I said, yeah, I'm trying to. How do we go about it? He said, well, I'm going to London on leave. I'll go to the Admiralty and ask them if, to the appointments people, and ask them if you can be appointed to the same squadron. And he came back a week or so later. I said, well, how did you get on? He said, well, they said, you know, you can't do that sort of thing. A week later, I got orders to go to Glasgow, get on to the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary, go to America, to 848 Squadron. And I never heard of Alistair Black again. I thought, well, he's already gone. I never met him. And I still think, if I ever get hold of the internet, I'm going to try and find if he's still around. So that put me in to America.
When we finish, give me his name and I'll do a search for you when I come back from
school. Right.
So you see, so you're on the Queen... Sorry, the Queen Elizabeth, was it?
Well, I forget if it was the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary. It was one of those...
Another high-speed dash.
Absolutely, a high-speed dash. It was 5 days. And, of course, practically empty because she was only full coming this way. And we got into New York.
And we're in early... 43.
This is
spring. 43.
Well, yes. Before, I mean, I didn't go straight. I got first. I had to go down to Leon Solent, where the whole squadron collected. Then we moved off and back up north again to go to sea in the Queen.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I thought you were under the impression you were going out alone to America. But no. This
oh no.
Squadron was formed up.
Yes.
And then
sorry. I that was my slip. I was appointed to 848 Squadron, forming up at Leon Solent. In fact, we just congregated there and then embarked in the Queen, whichever Queen it was, and went to America. And we went to we had about 5 days in New York, which was an absolute riotous time. Nobody could do enough for us. We were invited here, given free seats to the theatre, and invited to people's houses. It didn't seem real. And
again, the contrast of coming from wartime absolutely. Britain in 43, which must
and
have
no blackout, of course. So we then went to the U.S. Naval Air Station at Quonset Point in Rhode Island, and formed up there. There I was greeted by a chap called Wilkins, who was an observer, who had been in the sister squadron to us in Egypt. And he came up to me and said, I hope you don't mind, but I saw your name on the list, and I know you've had some experience, so I put my name down to fly with you. I said, fine. He was good, too.
Your rank now was you're still a...
Still a sub-lieutenant, actually. It was during this next period that I got my second stripe. anyway, we went to Quonset, and I got introduced to the Grumman Avenger, which, in fact, the Admiralty had decided to call the Tarpon. Tarpon, as you probably know, being a fish. It is a fish.
It's a kind of shark, isn't it?
It's kind of shark, yeah. Because they wanted all their aircraft to have sea mammal names. Did you want your glass, darling?
Yes, thank you.
Something on it?
Spider.
No,
it's a money spider.
Oh. Well, I hope it was a money spider. There are a lot of ants about.
So you're moving onto this plane that's called the Avenger,
yeah.
But the Admiralty insists on calling the
so
carpenter.
To me, it was enormous after the Swordfish and Albacore.
I don't know. Can you describe it? What sort of? It's all right. I mean,
right. Well, must have. A, I don't know. Oh, I know, I've got a picture of it in here.
Oh, I see, that's right.
Taking
so,
off.
Monoplane, cockpit cover the lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's for you, it must have been like jumping a good 20 years into the future.
Oh, yes,
rattling around.
It was. And the thing was, of course, there was no dual. I'd never flown a monoplane before. And I'd never flown a retractable undercarriage. It had all these sort of things. It even had folding wings, which you could fold from the cockpit. Anyway, somebody showed me the taps and what to do and what not to do, and I read the pilot's notes very carefully, and was sent off on a familiarisation flight, and I got airborne. I got to 10,000 feet, and I thought, how do you stop this thing climbing? And finally the penny dropped. I said, well, obviously I've got the nose too high, I haven't got the trim right. And so, you know, got that out, and I was quite happy. And it was a lovely aeroplane to fly, if providing you didn't want to do too many tight turns and things like that, because it got very heavy on the controls after at high speeds. However, that was okay, and so then we settled down to...
And did everyone cope with this?
Oh, yes.
Familiar process of not going up, there's no duel, you just, that's
no,
it. No one forgot to put the undercarriage down, coming back, or...
Well, we did have one case, somebody didn't. He either forgot to put his undercarriage down or he couldn't get it down. He did a belly landing on the aerodrome, but not, this was at another aerodrome, actually. So we settled down to another session of training and forming up, you know, doing the usual things, navigation exercises, anti-submarine bombing, WT exercises, you name it, we did it.
And you're living...
Formations.
You're living in considerable style after what you've been used to.
Oh, we're living very comfortably indeed, yes, yeah. I mean, I was amazed, actually, how... You went for a boiled egg, let's say, for breakfast. There'd be a whole tray of them there. And you might have to open two or three to find one that was cooked. It's like that. But we were, I mean, we lived extremely comfortably there. After all, they were at war, but they were America itself was a long way from the war.
Usually is.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Shouldn't have said that. In terms of the new equipment that you had on the aircraft, you had much more sophisticated navigational aids,
yeah.
I suppose.
And we also had a radio altimeter, which was rather like traffic lights. So if you wanted to fly 50 feet above the sea, you set that on the altimeter. And when you were on it, it was green. When you were below it, it was red. And the amber was sort of anywhere in between. So from the point of view of mine dropping and torpedo dropping, that was a great help, especially at night.
And you could rely on this?
Well, yes, I used it several times, and it was... I never went in the sea.
And flying with a covered cockpit?
Yeah. Very comfortable.
Oxygen, did you have... We wouldn't have...
No. No, we didn't have oxygen, actually, because we never actually got that sort of height. We did have a session in a compression chamber once just to demonstrate the effect of lack of oxygen, but we never actually had to use it.
Okay. What other training exercises did you do there? That
well, we also we did the usual ones. We did formation flying, wind finding, both at night. And we did the aerodrome deck landings again, because we had to do that. We did eventually go to a carrier and carry them out, but we did quite a lot of that, actually. And at one stage, we moved from Quonset Point, Rhode Island, to Brunswick in Maine, which I believe was known as the Pine Tree State. And they'd cut a whole lot of pine trees down and made a runway and a little naval air station, and we were made very welcome there, and just carried on all these forming up exercises like dummy torpedo attacks, navigation exercises, bombing, air firing, even did some drogue towing. Nothing sort of out of the usual.
And again, in this aircraft, you would have had an observer with you.
Had an observer and an air gunner, yes.
And an air gunner.
Because
yeah.
That aircraft had a gun turret with twin Brownings in it.
At the aft end of the cockpit.
On the top.
Sorry,
Adam. You can probably see it here. Yes, it's behind the cockpit, so
I see.
That's the pilot
there,
and then the observer, and then the turret. And there was also a tail gun there, which you could be used if necessary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, that's funny, I put the wrong number on that. I put 821 Avengers on a HMS Trumpeter. It's 848. Must have been dreaming. So, yeah, that's about all. Can't really see much more of that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So, this is the first time you're flying with two crewmen, isn't it?
No, we've had... I had an observer, an air gunner, in albacores quite often, yes.
Yeah.
And in swordfish. Except when you had a long-range tank in the back, then you had to kick the air gunner out.
Of course. Yeah. I'm just thinking if there's anything... I mean, I just like this idea of the sort of time leap forward, going onto this wonderful, sophisticated American plane.
Yes, quite. And, I mean, the power was so different. Gravel Avenger, Wright Cyclone, 1,600 horsepower.
So practically double.
Which, yes, and the albacore was 1,885. So it's another 600.
More.
Yeah. And the later ones had an even bigger engine. No, they didn't. Wrong. No, that's right. 1,600 horsepower.
Press the wrong button on the recorder. No, it's okay.
That's a better picture of an Avenger. You can see the cockpit layout better there. It's quite long with that gun turret at the back.
And so you go through the warming up exercises. You're now in Maine.
Yep.
And then?
And this went on till the end of August. We were then told to fly across the states to Seattle to join HMS Trumpeter, which was an escort carrier. And that was interesting because we 12 aircraft. In the morning we were supposed to go, it was thick fog. And the night before, people who we'd made friends with had given four or five of us a farewell party. And they gave us four more farewell parties before the fog lifted. They were very kind. And we flew then. In fact, of all the squadrons that had formed up there, we were the first to be allowed to fly across. The others had all been shipped by rail. So we set off with 12 aircraft. Now our first stop was Detroit, which was certainly the distance in America. Six and a quarter hours from Brunswick to Detroit at about, I think we cruised about 140 miles an hour.
Without refueling?
Yeah. Oh, yes, didn't have to refuel. We refueled each time. And the next stop was Fargo, North Dakota. And then Billings, Montana. And then on the last leg to Seattle, when we had to fly over the Rockies, we got about 10 or 11,000 feet, I think, and Wilkie in the back said, I have to tell you, we're being flooded with hydraulic fluid, which meant, obviously, that the gauge had broken and that this was flying all over the place. So, well, what do we do? Because we didn't know at that point whether we were going to land on Seattle Naval Air Station or on the carrier. Well, it wouldn't have been any good trying to land on the carrier without knowing if we'd got hydraulic power. So we said, well, if we see anywhere we can get down, we'll do it. And we came to a place called Spokane, which was on the Pacific side of the Rockies. And I could see there were a whole lot of B-25 bombers there. One runway. I said, well, we'll have to go down there. So we got in the circuit, the wheels came down all right, and the flaps seemed to work. And I said, well, the only thing maybe lacking now is the brakes. And unfortunately, I don't know how the B-25s got in and out of there, because it was not a very long runway. In the wind direction meant that you were landing downhill. So we sort of came in a carrier landing fashion as slow as possible, but of course there weren't any brakes, So we rolled and rolled and rolled. And I saw the aerodrome hedge coming up. So I thought the only thing to do is try and ground loop it. I pushed hard on the left rudder pedal and managed to swing round and face uphill. So we taxied back to a sort of offices and hangar, and an American sergeant came out and said, what's up with you guys, sort of thing. So we told him, he said, oh, no problem, get out and go and have a cup of coffee, we'll fix it for you. And we came back, all the hydraulic fluid had been cleaned out, new gauge put on, and what they'd done, they'd taken a gauge off a B-25 bomber and put that US and put that on us. I said, well, isn't there something to sign? No, nothing to sign. So we got back in and went off to Seattle. And then we did actually land at Seattle and went to... let's see what happened. Oh, we were there for 3 days and joined the trumpeter on September the 14th. And we did a bit of flying with her.
But was this your first deck landing? Because we actually haven't...
Oh, no, I beg your pardon. No, because before we finished our forming...